Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Picture that super soft t-shirt you love sleeping in. The one that gets softer and softer the more you wear it. Now you can bring that same lived-in softness to your entire bed with Signature Vintage Wash Sheets from Boll & Branch. This all-new collection is even softer than your favorite t-shirt, with a distinctly relaxed look and feel for your best night's sleep. Just like all Boll & Branch bedding, Signature Vintage Wash Sheets start with the highest quality, 100% organic cotton. The lived and feel comes from a small batch washing process, creating a level of softness you've never felt before. And it's not just the feel. Boll & Branch mastered the laid-back aesthetic using a special technique that creates the well-loved look you'll find with vintage jeans. And true to the Boll & Branch hallmark, Signature Vintage Wash Sheets get softer and softer with every wash. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order with promo code ODYSSEY and save on their most relaxing sheets. So head to BollAndBranch.com today. That's B-O-L-L and Branch.com.
A word of warning, this podcast explores graphic and disturbing stories and includes some strong language. It therefore may not be suitable for our young listeners or other folks who may find it disturbing. Hello and welcome to True Crime Daily, the podcast covering high-profile and under-the-radar cases from across the country every week. I'm your host, Anna Garcia, and joining us today is the host of the Law and Crime Network, and he's also an attorney, Jesse Weber. Welcome to the program, Jesse.
Anna, thank you so much for having me. It's quite an honor to be on this podcast. I've heard so much about it. It's really grown so well, so thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh, thank you. We love that. We love that. Okay, we've got some amazing cases this week, and honestly, one of them I'm obsessed with because it's one of the oldest cases that's a cold case in Orange County that's finally been solved, and I just love cases like that. So here's what we're looking at this week. A Los Angeles County judge dismissed the case against four social workers who were charged in connection with the torture death of an eight-year-old boy whose mother was under investigation by those social workers. So it's one of those, the system failing the child. But first, police in Orange County, California have solved a 52-year-old cold case, the oldest Jane Doe case in the county. It's unbelievable, Jesse. They used genetic genealogy to identify the not only the victim, but the suspected killer. It's incredible. This murder happened in 1968. They just didn't identify the victim, as I said. They think they even found the killer. The sad thing here is that both the victim and the killer are both dead now. So it's a limited victory, but I think it's so very hopeful. Isn't it incredible to see cases like this?
Well, I'm not surprised. You know, we're seeing a lot of this more and more. I mean, especially when you think about the Golden State Killer. We're in a very different world in 2020. It's not just because we're living in a pandemic and things are absolutely crazy, but the truth of the matter is, you know, this case, if you listen to it and you read about it, you're like, every so often, there was a breakthrough because there was a breakthrough in science. You know, they collected everything that they could, but what they realized is, okay, is DNA advanced? Well, now we can get a partial DNA print. Okay, is this advanced? Now we get a further clue. But genetic genealogy is something that is absolutely incredible because there's one thing to commit a crime in 2020, and it's very hard to escape that and to not leave a footprint. Crimes that were committed so long ago, we're not getting answers to. And like you said, look, it's really sad that both the killer or the suspected killer and the victim here are not around. But the problem, the truth is that's justice. We get for the family members of Ms. Pateau, they finally get an answer. What happened to her? And now that's what's incredible. And we're going to see more and more of this. I know we are.
Yeah, I think so. And it's interesting that the evidence never changed. They collected the evidence at the scene. They preserved it. They saved it. They protected it. But the science has changed that they were able to extract more and more as the decades went by from the very same pieces of evidence that existed on the day that they found her body.
We're talking about a cigarette butt. You know, they believe she was sexually assaulted, so a rape kit was conducted. If this was a trial, if Johnny Crisco, who is the guy that they believe did this, if there was a trial, you wouldn't really see an eyewitness account. You wouldn't have surveillance footage. You wouldn't have a ton of this. But there is a new sense of reliability with this genetic genealogy that allows people, and you could tell that story. So if you're a prosecutor and you're telling the story about how they were ultimately able to apprehend them, you'd believe it. I mean, I got to tell you, like from my point of view, you always have to be careful. You always have to say the alleged killer, the alleged murderer here, the suspect. But when you read about this case, everybody's definitive in saying he's the one who did it because the evidence is so strong with genetic genealogy. And that's what's incredible about it. It's something that law enforcement never had an opportunity to use before. And it's controversial. Let's call it what it is. It's very controversial. There's some constitutional issues. But when you're looking at the Golden State Killer who terrorized California for decades, and then all of a sudden you see him in a courtroom with a face mask on in the middle of the pandemic, and now he's going to be spending the rest of his life behind bars, it's absolutely incredible.
Yes. And what we're talking about is that when you submit your DNA to do your ancestry tests and you're spitting in this little tube, you don't realize it when you check off all these waivers to do this. But in essence, you are submitting your DNA into a massive data bank.
Well, let's be clear about this, right? So it's not like Johnny Crisco, again, the suspected killer here, or the Golden State Killer, Joseph James DeAngelo, ever did this. It's not like they went into a site and said, hey, I'm going to put my DNA up. They had family members or relatives who did it. And that's what's amazing. You submit a piece of evidence, DNA from the crime scene. It matches up to a relative. Police say, oh my gosh, that's interesting. Now let's look at this family tree. And through everyday, ordinary police work, they narrow it down to the suspect. So from a lawyer point of view, and what we're going to see more and more, the more we see this in trials, is defense attorneys saying, this is totally unfair. My client never submitted anything. This is a violation of their Fourth Amendment. And how can you say that this is fair? But at the end of the day, what I have to tell you, and this is my personal opinion, DNA and what you leave behind or what someone else leaves behind, I don't think you can expect that same degree of privacy, that same degree of that you don't believe law enforcement can invade your personal effects, your body in the same way. So I don't believe that those arguments are going to work so well, but it is an interesting thing to think about because these killers never really did that. They never went onto the website and submitted their own information. Somebody else related to them did that.
Yes, but in order for the police and the district attorney to build cases against these suspected killers, they then have to collect the DNA themselves, get a search warrant, dig through their trash, follow them, pull the pizza slice out, whatever they do, and then get that match independently. So, I mean, there are a few more layers beyond the family tree, but it is really, it's where the case turns.
Yeah,
so let's go back to the facts.
Yeah, right.
Let's go back and look at this case because it's so interesting. So it was March 14th, 1968. Can you imagine? Does anybody even remember what was going on in 1968 in the world? Three boys were playing on a farm and they found the body of a young woman in a field in Huntington Beach, California. She had been sexually assaulted. She was beaten and her neck was slashed, but no one knew who she was. She was just Jane Doe. And she was buried in an unmarked grave in Newport Beach, California. So here's what she was wearing: a floral print blouse, purple pants, and size 7 shoes. They were loafers, but because the loafers were made in upstate New York, for a moment there, detectives thought, oh, maybe we can figure out where these shoes were sold and who bought the shoes and does she look like anybody who bought the shoes? That didn't go anywhere. Now, because of today's DNA technology, we now know she was Anita Louise Pateau, and police believe her killer, as you said, was Johnny Crisco. Now, using DNA evidence that was collected 52 years ago and then preserved, this is how they solved it. Now, let's talk about the last time anyone heard from Anita, because what we have to remember here is for more than 50 years, the family of this woman had no idea what happened to her. It's as if she disappeared off the face of the earth. She was dead, but they didn't know it, right? So you can imagine all sorts of things. The last time they heard from her, Jesse, she had written home some postcards and some letters to the family. And this happened 1 month before she was killed. She grew up in Maine, so she sent them the postcards there. She was one of seven children from Augusta, Maine. This is just to give you an idea of what was going on in Anita's life before she was killed, because at the end of the day, we're talking about a human life and a person. So she had moved to California a few months earlier. She was working as a waitress. She was doing really touristy things. And she told her family, I will be home by May. Mm-hmm. Right. So they were expecting her home. And that's it. That's the last anyone in that family heard from her.
And that's so eerie, because when you think about it, people who leave out of state, the worst nightmare of a family is my child, is my sister. Are they going to be safe when you go to this faraway land? And, you know, you listen to the family members that said that she was very adventurous. She wanted a different kind of life. But the idea that she was actually planning to come home, but she never returned home, is what makes that so eerie. That's one of the reasons I think investigators didn't know who she was. She wasn't, her house wasn't nearby. It wasn't like she grew up there. And yeah. That's what's so tragic and why it took so long.
Yeah, and trying to match things. You know, we think of everything in the terms of what is available to us now and technology. That was not the case back then. There was no social media. There was no intranet. I mean, there was none of this. So you have to understand everything was very slow. And really, when you think about it, manually, you're making a call. So the DNA evidence that was collected also includes the killer's DNA, the suspected killer, Johnny Crisco, who in 1963, this would have been 5 years before Anita's murder, had been discharged by the army because of psychological problems. He was violent and he was very aggressive. So that's just a little information on him. And what's interesting is that no one is quite sure if they knew each other, and if they did, how they knew each other, right?
Yeah, so there are theories out there that he might have gone on a date with her. Believe it or not, if you look at a picture of him before he passed away, doesn't look like much. But when you listen to what he was like back in the day, they said he was very charming. He's kind of this bad boy reputation. And obviously there was a component of sexual assault here. So there was a belief, how did they know each other? Perhaps he took her on a date. Things went obviously the wrong way. That's a theory. We're probably never going to know what the connection was. But maybe that makes sense. Maybe if people try to understand exactly what happened.
Well, I think what will happen now that their names have been identified, and now because of social media, let's just say buddies of his that may still be alive, or relatives of his that may be alive, and girlfriends that she may have had here at the time may say, oh my God, I remember now Anita was going to go on it. You know, I think that is going to be filled in because of technology now that we may hear the memories of people. Right. Because if you were her girlfriend, you'd be like, what happened to Anita? She never came home.
Well, what's fascinating is as soon as it came out that they believe he's the person who did this, his exes came out and some said there's no way he could have done this. And some said, yeah, I totally believe it. So once you put in people's minds that this is who he was and who she was, people said, oh, yeah, I remember that. And there's a hotline right now. There's a tip line. If you know anything about this case, now that we have more details, come forward. So, yeah, maybe I spoke a little prematurely and said we'll never really know. But to think about these two, and they were really strangers, how they connected on that night is just, you know, you wish you could go in a time machine and obviously disconnect them. But that's the problem right there when you think about it.
Yeah, and he apparently had a long string of arrests, so he was always getting into trouble with the law. He had been married and divorced 3 times, so he didn't exactly, plus the discharge that makes, you know, suggestions about other issues he may have had. So he clearly had his own issues here.
Well, there was also a history of violence against women. So if you think about it, he was accused, not a ton of convictions, by the way, but a lot of allegations that he abused the women that he was involved with, on top of the fact that my understanding is he went to the military on an allegation or possible record of statutory rape. And there was also allegations of child molestation. So when you think about this history of his, first of all, I think it's remarkable when you hear about the women who he was involved with who said that, thank goodness, we were never a victim of his, but to commit this crime or allegedly commit this crime and then live an entire life, but to hear what he was up to, it kind of makes sense as a pattern.
Yeah, it really does, isn't it? The whole thing is so scary. And to think about that he was never even considered a suspect at the time. He
right.
just was not on the radar of the detectives on this murder. For whatever reason, we don't know. So let's go through some of the evidence that was actually preserved that day. So they collected things like tire tracks. They made copies of the tire tracks because this was in a field. There was a cigarette butt that was found near the body that was taken and collected. And also, of course, they kept her clothes. And because she had been sexually assaulted, they did a rape kit. So they were able to gather some DNA there. So for years, nothing happens with this, right? Nothing. Then 2001, things start changing in science and technology as far as DNA. So that gave the cops the ability to extract some of the DNA from her clothes and from the rape kit and get a better idea of what was going on. The results come back and all they have is it's an unknown male. Okay, well, we kind of suspected there was a male involved to begin with, so there's no progress there. Now, yeah. 10 years later, this is 2011, okay? Things are really changing. Cops were able now to match the DNA on the cigarette butt to the DNA from the rape kit. And Jesse, tell me how important that is, because that's not just like a random cigarette butt anymore, right? In this case, if you're going to prosecute.
Well, I think there's a couple of things to note. One, I don't want anyone to have the impression that this wasn't a thorough investigation back in the late 60s. They did whatever they could do to try to find out. So that means collecting any piece of evidence. Who knew that cigarette butt, which could have been related to the crime or not, how important it would have been. But to collect that on top of the actual victim, what was found on the victim, now you're connecting it. Now you're getting a better sense of what happened here. By the way, got to tell you got Johnny Crisco, who died in 2015 from throat cancer, smoke and cigarettes. You know, you kind of put two and two together to get the story here. But really, that was a huge breakthrough because, as you said, they didn't know that 10 years ago, the 10 years before that. They didn't know it back in the 60s. And as it said, this case progressed as science progressed.
Exactly. So now we have the cigarette butt is matching the DNA in the rape kit. So they took some DNA from a blood stain on Anita's blouse. And also they took her fingerprints and they put it in the system. Remember, by this time, we're starting to see things more computerized information, even though it's not nearly as good as it is now, but we're seeing advances there. So they entered into the National Database for Missing Persons to see if they could identify the victim. And Jesse, nothing pops. Still nothing. Then last year, it's like the seas parted, the skies opened, everything is clear again. Last year, everything changed when they started doing family trees. Okay, so Huntington Beach police and the DA's investigators decided to start making a family tree for the suspected killer. It's interesting. They start that way with the DNA that way as opposed with the murder victim. And again, he was apparently never a suspect, but he was a career criminal. And then this year they start the DNA tree for the victim. And that's how they were able to identify Anita. And here's the twist that I love in all of this. Okay, so there was a woman who is kind of an expert in this area of tracing family trees. And she had a relative who had disappeared. And she thought, my God, maybe it's this Jane Doe. So she contacts the Huntington Beach police to try to work with them. Okay, it's not her relative. But she turns to the cops and she says, okay, this doesn't help me or my family, but can I help you with my mad skills? And so she helps them build the family trees. Isn't that, I mean, I get chills just even thinking about that, how like it didn't help her, but she still had the goodwill and the good heart to help some other family. And look what she did.
Well, thank goodness, because again, the police don't know about this technology and they didn't have these tools available. So I'm actually curious as more and more cases come up, and this is a really cool science, especially if you're really into cold cases and trying to solve them, if you're going to see more people enter into this arena, you're going to see more people try to get careers in this, because what she did, she's the hero of the story, obviously. I mean, to think about making, connecting these dots. And my understanding is she was able to connect it pretty quickly, you know,
yeah.
And that's what's amazing.
She's just really extraordinary, and I just love that. It's like a citizen detective, if you will, and they're so helpful now. So since the news is broken, but actually right before they broke the news, the authorities here in California were able to dig up what used to be Jane Doe's grave, took the remains, and they were taken to Maine. And Anita has been properly buried with her family, and she was given a proper memorial service. And one of the DA investigators actually went to the service. Obviously, he took Anita back to the family, and he stayed. You know, I mean, they're not going to FedEx the woman after all this. So that's a beautiful, lovely ending to a tragic, tragic story.
And I think the note that they left was, "We miss you." That's just such a touch to this, because think about if she was alive, what impact she could have had in their family. And this was something, a mystery that they never really understood. Think about this, to not even know what happened to her. You know, they thought she was alive. They thought she was dead. To not have that certainty is sometimes worse than obviously knowing the truth of what happened. So yeah, we talk about what's justice. Clearly, Johnny Crisco, if he's the one who did this, he passed away. He's not in jail. He never was punished for this. But yet the family has closure. That's justice.
And I will say, and I don't mean to sound mean here, but when Johnny Crisco died, nobody claimed his body, not a family member, not a friend. So he kind of died alone. And he ended up getting, because he was a veteran, he got some recognition at a memorial service. But if his death is a little cold and a little lonely, I'm okay with that.
Well, that's what they think about his life anyway. If you read it, his life was cold and lonely. It was just a guy who actually said that he was in Vietnam and bragged about it when really that wasn't the case. You know, I think the furthest he ever got was Fort Bragg. So this is a guy who his death seemed to echo his life.
And the DA did say that it was sad that Anita's family, Anita and her family, cannot get full justice because Johnny Crisco is dead. But again, there is some justice here, not exactly what they wanted. And, you know, the other great thing is we say now about technology and social media. So one of the original investigators on this case, who is now 89 years old, Earl Robitaille, remembers this case because it always bothered him. And he says, "My God, DNA was not even an option. It wasn't a thought. It wasn't even anything. Yep. It wasn't a seed in our brains." And he said he does remember one thing, that there was a forensic dentist who was trying to help them because they were trying to really figure this out. And the dentist insisted that the victim had such bad dental work done that the dentist said Mexico. She had her teeth fixed in Mexico. So like the team does this huge U-turn, and the focus of the investigation goes towards Mexico, whether she may be Mexican or, and it really was like a ridiculous detour that took them nowhere.
Yeah, it's a rabbit hole that they unfortunately went down, but that is just the circumstance of the technology. You do what you can do. And so they're going to follow what leads they were going to follow. Unfortunately, that was really out there, but that is just a circumstance of not having enough information, not having the tools available at the time. So I can't blame them. Again, I want to make it very clear. None of the investigators did anything wrong here. It was just the circumstance that this woman was killed in 1968.
Yeah. In fact, I was looking on the Huntington Beach police Facebook page yesterday. And, you know, Huntington Beach is not a really big community, right? It's got a lot of tourists, but there's a set group of people who have grown up in Huntington Beach like any other community. And it was wonderful. There was a posting from a woman who said, her dad was a cop and he's no longer alive. And she said, "I remember how this case ate at my father. I wish that he were alive to see this today." Again, more than 50 years ago. So a lot of people won't be alive. Thank God for Earl, who's 89 years old.
Right. And amazing memory. I can't even remember what I had for lunch. So it's pretty amazing to think about that. But the truth of the matter is, you know, we look at this from across the country and wow, what an amazing case. But to think about if you're part of that community and your parents or grandparents said, "I remember that case. What a mystery." This is not something of three boys find a woman out in a field and no one knows who she is. That's a story that, you know, goes through history and everybody was trying to figure it out. And kudos to law enforcement to never giving up. You know, never giving up. They could have given up on this. They could have given up, especially when the family didn't even know what happened. There was like they kept asking the police department, "Do you have any leads?" But they never gave up. No matter what happened, as there was advancements in technology. I think that's amazing because there are so many cold cases, but to stay vigilant with it, that's something that I was surprised about, and obviously worked out.
Yeah, what I'm seeing a lot, and we're reporting a lot of this on this podcast, because, you know, finally there is some form of justice or resolution, that it is getting much easier to work a cold case, if you will, because as long as you have preserved evidence, you can start extracting the DNA because there's new technology to do that, and you can go ahead and start submitting it. And the more you do that, you know, that doesn't take a lot of work is what I'm saying. You know, you don't have to go back and interview 100 people. Now you can let the DNA and the science do that work for you. And I think we are going to get a lot more solved because of it.
We also don't know how many people have already submitted their information to genealogic websites. And look, some websites are going to fight this. They don't want to cooperate with law enforcement. They want to protect the privacy of their customers. I get that. But at the same point, so many people have already done it for all different kinds of reasons. They want to know their family tree, you know, all these different things. But to think about what's already on there and what could connect you, that's why we live in a day and age where it's almost impossible to commit a murder and get away with it. Not just for this, but, you know, the technological advances between surveillance footage and cameras and DNA and cell phones, you leave a footprint. But now with this, it's becoming almost inescapable that unless you really don't leave a DNA footprint on a crime scene, that you would get away with it. That's the chilling part. So I wonder, I always think about this. Are there people out there who are like, oh, great, I got away with it for 30 years, 40 years. I hope, you know, I don't know. And I always think that. Did the Golden State Killer know that he was going to be picked up one day? Did he know
that he didn't care?
Not at all. Exactly.
No, absolutely not. Are you kidding? Killing? Can you know that, right? Yeah. No, he was brazen. Wow, what a case. Thank you so much for your insight on this one.
Of course.
So, Jesse, staying in California for our next case, but we're moving over now to a neighborhood called Palmdale. This has become a national story. It is, of course, a national issue, and there's even a Netflix documentary about this case. You know, we cover a lot of cases about children who die at the hands of their abusive parents, and then, you know, naturally, we always ask, almost all of the time, almost, these families and these children are either under investigation, either under the supervision of Child Protective Services, or the children have been taken away and brought back, right? So we see this theme all of the time in crimes against children. And what is so unique about this case is that authorities decided to go ahead and charge the social workers with a form of child abuse because of their inactions may have led to the death of this child. And yeah, that's what I find interesting here.
Yeah. I understand. First, let me just say, I've covered a ton of child abuse cases, trials regarding it, horrific things. This is the worst case of child abuse that I personally have ever heard, ever. And I hate talking about it. I mean, it's important to talk about it. It's such a pivotal case, but it's the most disturbing thing I've ever heard. And I think the problem is, and one of the reasons that people love true crime, people want a sense of understanding why. Why do these crimes happen? Why would somebody do this? And the problem that I keep coming back to with this case is I don't understand why. I really don't understand. I don't understand why this child died, and I don't understand how this case slipped through the cracks. And as much as I look into it, as much as I've read the law on it, I still am left with that. And that's what I'm actually so disturbed by, that I wish I had a better answer for it. But it is just absolutely chilling to think that this still happens and that this could happen. And to think about the young boy here, what he went through, if everybody just takes a step back and think about that, that's something I just can't process.
I can't process it, but over and over, it is the same story. Abusive parents kill their children. Children cry out for help. And in this case, this little 8-year-old, according to court records, wrote a suicide note. So there are almost always cries for help. People see things, people hear things, and yet these children still die at the hands of their parents and in the most heinous ways that anyone can imagine. It is disgusting. It is disturbing. And I don't know, can the law ever truly protect a child from a demented parent that has no moral compass and has no problem torturing a child and then killing him or her?
especially when you have people who work for a Department of Child and Family Services that take the word of the parent over the child. And, or you have a situation where you don't assess, well, maybe the child is not really telling the truth about what's going on because they're afraid of the parent or the caregiver. That's what happened here. That's what happened here. So many instances where this could have been averted if you just would have listened, but you didn't. And only, and I know we're going to go through the facts of this case, but the teacher in this case was the only one who was listening and tried to do as much as she could to save this child. But at the end of the day, there was nothing more to do.
No. So what this case is, what the latest in this long case is that this has been an attempt to hold the social workers responsible for the death of this 8-year-old. So these charges were brought against four Los Angeles County social workers, two social workers and two and the two supervisors. The boy had been beaten and tortured by his mother and by her boyfriend. The boy, Gabriel Fernandez, died in May of 2013, and we're still discussing this 7 years later. So a few weeks ago, the judge hearing the case against the social workers dropped the charges against them. Now, the four had visited the child, and this is what's so interesting. You know, they were involved with, like, two had visited, and then the supervisors. Yet, with all this crap going on, nobody found that there was reason enough to remove the child. And this case, you know, living here in Los Angeles, I can tell you that this is the kind of case that we all have talked about and heard and seen the progression. And it was years after even the mother and the boyfriend were convicted of murdering the child that the charges were brought against the social workers. It was a way for the authorities here in Los Angeles County to try to hold someone accountable, that it wasn't enough to say the kid slipped through the cracks, right? And that's what this case was about, this most recent legal case. So Gabriel's mother, Pearl Fernandez, was sentenced to life in prison without parole for the murder of her son. And her boyfriend, Isaro Aguirre, was sentenced to death with special circumstances because he's the one who apparently physically tortured the boy in this instance. The question was, and it is still now, were these social workers incompetent? Did the system work against the child and maybe the social workers to make it possible for them to make a difference? Or were these social workers actually child abusers because of the end results? And that's what this case was trying to resolve, but the judges dropped the charges and said, no, you know, we cannot charge you with child abuse.
Well, there's a couple of things there. So one, they were charged with child abuse and also falsifying records.
Yes, we're going to get to that too.
And the thing with that is, so when I was in law school, one of the things that we always learned was a judge, a court, they always think about a slippery slope. Well, if we hold this person accountable, what happens here? And I think a big concern was if we hold social workers accountable, if we hold them criminally liable for the actions of the caregiver, the actions of a parent, we're going to have a situation where social workers are going to be more concerned about their careers than the safety of the children. Because if you flip it around and you say, well, I'm going to take this child away, even if I hear that the parent slapped the child once, I'm going to take the child out there because I'm afraid that I'm going to be convicted and I'm going to be sentenced to child, you know, convicted of child abuse and sentenced. When in reality, it might be beneficial to keep the child in that home and do a situation of counseling or things like that. Here the problem was, and the court said that you, and this, we can get into the law of it, about how they ultimately decided that these social workers shouldn't be held accountable, but it was a situation where they didn't want to have a slippery slope, that we can't hold social workers to this level of degree. They could be fired. You could say that they were really bad at their jobs. That's one thing, but to hold them criminally liable here is a different story. I have my own opinion about that because I think that that's not an, we can't just paint a brush and say that social workers are not always responsible, because there's a situation here, and the court said the same thing, like it's a police officer, right? So if a police officer ultimately shoots someone, you can ultimately charge the officer with murder. But if an officer chooses not to arrest somebody, you're not going to prosecute the officer for doing that. You can fire the officer, and that's how they made that comparison. I think if you're in the position of your whole responsibility as a social worker is to protect the child, and there's ample evidence the child dies from that, and you allegedly falsified reports, you are entering into a different threshold. So you could say, yeah, the court said, oh, they weren't really officers under the statute, or they didn't have legal control over the child in the same way that a caregiver has, or they didn't have legal control over the parents, so they're not responsible. Yeah, I get it. I'm a lawyer. I can read through the text myself. I still think that there was an element here that was missing, and I think there was a tragedy here with what happened.
And the four social workers were immediately put on whatever desk duty is for a social worker. I'm really not sure. Then they were ultimately fired, and then these charges were brought against them. So there were actions that were taken without question. And I do believe in my heart that no one wants to see a child tortured and no one wants to see a child die. But at the end of the day, if you are tasked with trying to protect a child and you are either the allegations about the falsifying of the records included things like records that were incomplete, notes that didn't have the details that reflected what should have been in an interview, not fully interviewing the child or saying that you did interview the child and you didn't. Failure to see that the child's physical condition was clearly deteriorating and not noting that in the notes. Those are some of the examples.
Well, just to add to that, they also said in the reports that the mother, Pearl, and the young boy, Gabriel, they both had the capacity to go through counseling and that Pearl had a support system. What? If you read through the facts of that, how do you, on earth, do you think that that's the case? So that's where it kind of became that clearly they were lying about what it was. I mean, do you really have that bad a judgment or did you falsify the report?
What's also interesting is that, and this happens a lot, police, the sheriff's department, because sheriffs patrol in that area, were called to the house numerous times. I believe there's something like 9 sheriff's deputies who had responded to the house over the years. And, you know, that's always an indication that there's trouble. And one of the points here is, okay, so they would have either knocked on the door, entered the house, and they themselves did not think that the situation for which they were called ever warranted removing the child, arresting the parents, or doing something, correct? So it's not just the social workers here.
Right. Well, there's a problem. And the problem was is that whenever there was a visit to the home, Gabriel, who would originally tell his teacher that he was being abused, she saw the bruises, he would change his story when there was a visit and say, oh, it was an accident, I was just joking. The other kids who were in the house would say, we've never saw anything. I believe Pearl and her boyfriend took drug tests that came back negative. So it looked like a situation. And by the way, Pearl said that her son, Gabriel, was making all this up or embellishing because he really wanted to live with the grandparents. He has social issues. He's aggressive. So the fact that they flipped the narrative, I understand there was confusion here. And I get that. But also, as I said at the beginning, you have to read through the lines. You have to read through the lines. Is it not possible that Gabriel was scared, that the kids were scared, that the mother and the boyfriend were saying whatever they needed to say in order to get out of it? I mean, yeah, hindsight's 20/20, but...
Aren't you worried? As I was reviewing the facts last night for this, I started thinking about, because of the pandemic and because of the limited services and the reduced face-to-face contact or visits, I know that domestic violence has increased, but what about the kids who are being abused? Like, if we thought that the system was imperfect and still is it not far worse now when these kids are even more vulnerable?
And that's an amazing question, because you have to think about what is the process that goes into these visits now. Are you doing it over Zoom when you could hide a lot of what's going on? Do you make a visit when everybody who makes a visit to another person's home wearing a mask, all you want to do is run out of there as quickly as possible? And this is not like a domestic violence situation where you can have a spouse call up and say they're in trouble. You have young children who have no way to ask for help. I think you've really hit it on the head. So this pandemic is creating a worse situation in a lot of ways, including that.
So let's go into the facts of what happened with Gabriel a little bit more. When paramedics found him, he's 8 years old. He was naked. He wasn't breathing. He was severely beaten. His skull was crushed in. He had 3 broken ribs. And he had been shot with a BB gun. And the pellets of the BB gun were lodged in his lung and in his groin. Okay.
And burns.
So in 2016, so that would have been 3 years after Gabriel's death, that is when the two social workers and their supervisors were finally charged with the one count of felony child abuse, one count of falsifying the records. And the prosecutors kept saying over and over again, they missed warning signs. And I know we just talked about that, but there's a theme here, right? So when they looked at the records, because there was a grand jury, and fortunately, as a result of the grand jury, that's the other thing that's not happening now, Jesse. Grand juries are not being convened. They can't because of the social distancing issue.
Right.
So that's when they found a lot more information. And, you know, one of the biggest problems that I find with getting justice for children of child abuse, especially when the system is involved, is that both the Department of Family Services, their attorneys, all claim that all of this information is privileged, confidential, and can never be released. And that is why the public and reporters, it's something I have fought against here in LA County for a long time, you know, advocating for more transparency because of cases like this. And I have to tell you, we've barely made a dent.
It's a sensitive, because you're dealing with sensitive subject matter. You know, there's one thing, you're dealing with children. And I get that argument. But I think this is the kind of situation where you need even more transparency. And look, the sad fact of the matter is, when you have a case like Gabriel Fernandez that makes it to the headlines, there has to be change. There has to be. Because unfortunately, while we see this more and more, people are realizing that it shouldn't be happening. And there needs to be a change in the system.
So as part of the further investigation into what happened to Gabriel and the grand jury hearings, and finally some of this stuff was made public, we found out that Gabriel's older siblings testified that Gabriel had been forced to eat cat feces. And if he vomited, he was forced to eat his vomit. He slept locked in a cabinet with a sock in his mouth to keep him from screaming. So that's the life that he lived. And it may not be criminal what happened to the others who were responsible for Gabriel's life and safety, but it's morally a crime. It is morally a crime what has happened to this child.
And I think that they realize that. So even though they don't have criminal liability, they have all expressed regret and they all understand that this is a nightmare. They all wish they could have done something different. You know, I remember hearing that one of the supervisors said that 200 cases he was overlooking, but this is the one that's going to haunt him for the rest of his life, and rightfully so. So this is a situation where, you know, if you have a textbook example of what we should have done more, this is that example. This is the one that you need to say, we need to change the way that we're doing this because it didn't work. That's the end of the problem. At the end of the day, nobody cares how you build a watch. They just want it to work. At the end of the day, we want children to be safe. We want the social workers to do their job and do everything that they can. So when the fact of the matter is, the teacher, Gabriel's teacher, seemed to be doing more because every time he came in with a bruise or any time she suspected something, she did her duty and immediately contacted the social workers. There were times towards the end of this, and again, when the social workers were told these different stories that Gabriel's really fine and all this, when they stopped returning her calls. So the teacher, I really believe, was the hero of this entire saga and tried to do as much as she could. But there's only so much a teacher can do. They're supposed to report it, but they're not supposed to go in the home and take the child away.
Yeah. I'm just going to leave you with a final note from the judge about this case, about whether those social workers and their supervisors can be held accountable in cases like this. And this is what the higher court ruled. Although there may be consequences to social workers who fail to fulfill their duties, the consequences do not include criminal liability for child abuse. But as I said, morally, yes, absolutely. So it's time for our comment section. These are the crime stories that you all are talking about. Georgia inmates are praised after saving the life of a deputy in the jail. Okay, so three inmates at the Gwinnett County Jail are being called heroes after they helped to save the life of a deputy who was having some kind of a heart attack. So the inmates were locked in their cells, and then they saw the deputy like lose consciousness and fall. and he split his head open from their perspective. So the inmates, they're locked in their cells and there's nothing they can do. So they're screaming, and that's not getting the attention of anyone outside. So they're calling to the fallen deputy, trying to see if they can wake him, you know, with the screaming and the banging and all of this. And so he manages to hear them calling his name. He manages to get on his feet, and then he presses the button to open the cells, right? And so the first people to render any help to him are the very people that he is tasked with keeping incarcerated. And so they came to his assistance, and this is what I love. They actually called for help. They went to the deputy's desk. They got on the phone calling for help. They took his radio, radioed for help, and that's ultimately what ended up, you know, saving his life. He is now recuperating at home. And that's such a hopeful story, isn't it?
See, I think it's like the Shawshank Redemption, but the PG version, like the good version, you know, because if you think about prison, it's supposed to be rehabilitative. What a great job. I mean, these guys are fantastic. I also do wonder if they think like, hey, maybe we'll get time off, you know, for good behavior. If you're talking about good behavior, what better than doing this?
Really, I mean, in a time of COVID, if there's anything that expresses to me clearly with actions, not with words, that you have, that you value human life, this is the action that proves that to me. I totally agree with you.
You look at prisoners and inmates, it's sometimes like you dehumanize them. People are like, oh, there's, you know, forget about them. Who cares about them? Human beings too, you know, human beings too, who are sometimes do these really good humane action. So, I mean, it's a good story to come out of prison, which you don't really see. You never see a good story coming out of prison.
No, not really. And so this is what our listeners and viewers posted. Martha D writes, so if they aren't violent criminals, release them early. Some states are releasing real criminals because of COVID. Totally agree with you, Martha. David O writes, not everyone behind bars is a bad person. Absolutely. And Alejandra D writes, finally, something good. I agree. Let's end this very sad podcast with something hopeful here. Jesse, this was a pleasure. Where can people find you and follow you on social media?
First of all, Anna, thank you so much. This was amazing to do this with you. So if you want to follow, obviously, what I do, you can go to Long Crime. I'm also the co-host of a radio show out in New York City with my father called Always in Fashion. So you can visit the 710WR website. But for social media, Twitter at Jesse Cord Weber, or on Instagram at Real J Weber.
Okay, tell me about this radio show with your dad. It has nothing to do with crime.
Thank goodness it has nothing to do with crime. So my dad has had quite the storied career in the fashion apparel industry, wrote a book, turned it into a radio show. I came with him one day. I was joking around with him and I said, we want you to be a co-host with him. And literally what it is a father and son show. We talk about business. We talk about fashion. We talk about life, all different kinds of career lessons, lifestyle. How often do you get a father and son show? So we've been doing this for about 4 years. It's really fun to do. We have a good back and forth. I love it. I love it. And it's kind of light, you know, none of this whole stuff that we get into. So it's a little bit of a change of dynamic.
Oh my God. I love that. And so I'm not in New York, but are the episodes online or
where?
Yeah. Okay.
So if you go Apple Podcasts.
Oh, great. Okay.
iHeartRadio app. You can listen to all of them.
Oh, I love that. Thank you, Jesse. I can't wait to listen to you and your dad talk fashion. Nobody's dead.
Thank you, Anna.
Oh, well, that is it for our show. As always, you can find our content on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever it is that you get your podcasts, and of course on YouTube. If you want to subscribe to our newsletter at truecrimedaily.com, please do. We would love it. So until next week, this is True Crime Daily, the podcast. I'm Anna Garcia, and as we always say, don't do crime.